source of particles. So particles are streaming out of this thing. And these particles could be anything. They could be electrons, they could be atoms, they could be molecules, they could be neutrons, they could be protons, whatever. As long as they're small, like, you know, atomic and or subatomic particles. Okay, just for definiteness, let's suppose that they are electrons. Okay, so this is called an electron gun. An electron source, whatever you want to call it. Okay, so out of this electron source, we have a beam of electrons. Okay, and these electrons have a certain amount of momentum, P. Okay, so if some of you may not even have talked about, how many of you don't know what momentum is? Okay, so momentum is just simply mass times velocity. It's the oomph of motion that something has. In fact, if you look back at Newton's Principia, momentum is what he called motion. Okay, the motion of an object is its momentum. It's how much oomph something has. Okay, so here is an eraser. If I throw this thing at some velocity, it has some oomph. If it hits something, I'll do a certain amount of damage. Okay, so I take the mass of the object times its velocity. If I increase the velocity, that object has more oomph. Okay, similarly, if I increase the mass, I give it more oomph. Okay, so if I'm walking at 1 meter per second, I have a certain amount of oomph in my motion. If I hit that wall, I'm going to do a little bit of damage. Well, very tiny amount of damage. Right, but if I'm a freight train, I got a lot more mass moving at the same velocity. If I hit that wall, I'll just go right through that wall. There's a lot more oomph of motion. Okay, so that's the basic idea of momentum, how much oomph of motion you have. Oomph is a technical word, essentially. Okay, now this beam of electrons comes flying out, and what we do is we put a screen here, but that screen has a slit in it. It's a single slit experiment that we're doing here. Okay, so what's going to happen is most of these electrons are going to just hit the screen, and they're just going to bounce off like this. Okay, but some of them are going to pass through that slit. Okay, and they're going to go into the other side of that screen. Okay, and on the other side of the screen, we have a second screen here, and this is our detector screen. Okay, and so these electrons are going to fly through the hole and hit this detector screen at various locations. So we have basically detectors, the electron detectors lining the whole screen, so we can detect where the electron hits the screen. Okay, so that's the idea here. That's the basic setup. Okay, and we'll just put a coordinate system on here, guys. Okay, now here's the thing. If we turn on this electron source, this beam of electrons, shower of electrons starts passing through here. Some of the electrons pass to that slit and so on. And what we're going to see, if the momentum of the electrons is high, if they're very fast-moving electrons, what we're going to see is electrons hitting the screen at random locations. Okay, we'll talk a little bit more about that later, but they'll be hitting the screen basically in this area over here. More precisely, if we draw sort of a line of sight here, okay, from the source, we'll imagine it's a point source, in the slit here, what we're going to see is that when the momentum of the electrons is large, we'll see that the electrons hit somewhere in this region of the screen, just at random locations. Suppose we have the electrons coming once every second. Doom, 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 doom. We'll see doom, 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 like that. Okay, we won't have electrons hitting outside of this region. So this would be called the shadow region. Shadow is here. Similarly, shadow is here. Okay? So that's for large momentum. So what we'll do is we will indicate that by drawing a picture like this. This is a graph. Okay, so this graph indicates that there's a high probability that the electrons will hit in this region, but zero probability they'll hit in these shadow regions over here. Okay, and that's that. So let me just label this as this is for large P, large momentum. Okay, now let's suppose that we crank down the momentum. Okay, so we say reduce the velocity of that beam of the electrons. Okay, so the electrons are coming through more slowly. Well, then we notice something very curious happens. We notice that electrons, sure, most electrons still hit in this region over here, Okay? But we notice that electrons begin to hit in the shadow region. Okay, the electrons are coming once per second. It'll be going like this. Doom, 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 doom. We'll see one over there. Okay, doom, 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 doom. So occasionally we'll see electrons hitting in this shadow region. Okay, and so we will get a curve, a probability curve, that looks more like this. Look like something like that. So this is this large P. Smaller P is this one. And similarly, if we keep on reducing the momentum, reducing the velocity, electrons are coming through more, even more and more slowly, what we will see is that the electrons will deviate even further. Okay, and they will penetrate even further into the shadow region, and our probability curve gets even more spread out. Okay, so it might look something like this. Okay, so this is just three examples. For the experiment done with three different momenta. Okay, and we will get this sort of pattern of hits here. Okay, so this is so there are two very, very important observations to make about this experiment. Okay, so the first observation is the randomness, the random nature of the hits on the screen. So the fact is, we can't, for any given electron that's coming through here, we can't predict in advance where it's going to hit the screen. Okay, so let's suppose the electrons are coming once every 5 minutes. Okay, so big electron is emitted. An electron that's emitted, we have no way of predicting exactly where it's going to hit the screen. Okay, so suppose we are dealing with, say, this momentum over here. Okay, what we can say is there's a fairly high probability it'll hit somewhere over here, and a lower probability it'll hit over here, but we can't tell you exactly where it's going to hit the screen in advance. Okay, so there's fundamentally some randomness involved in quantum mechanics. Okay, and we'll see if this is quantum mechanics. Okay, and that randomness is fundamental. It's not like the randomness of rolling a die. Okay, a six-sided die, right? I roll this, I get a 5, next time I get a 3, whatever. There's some randomness associated with that. It's a more fundamental kind of randomness than that. Okay? And we will talk a lot about that as we go along. Okay, so the first point to observe is there is randomness involved. And this curve here, we will call this curve P of x. Okay, so P of x, so this curve is some function of x. When x equals 0, the curve is this value. When x equals 1, the curve is this value, and so on. So it's some function of x. Okay, and we'll call that the probability distribution, probability function. So P of x is a probability. Probability that a given electron will hit a location x. Okay. So for all of those curves, P of x, when we set x equal to 0, P of x is a large number, and as x increases in either direction, up or down, P of x function decreases. Okay, so the first thing we notice is that somehow associated with this experiment is randomness and probability. Okay, the second main observation that we see from this is a spreading of P of x. So spreading of that probability curve as the momentum decreases. So for large momentum, very fast electrons, we see this first curve, P of x, where the electrons basically hit just in this region and none hit in the shadow region. But as we crank the momentum down, that probability curve spreads out. Okay? And that's extremely bizarre, because these are, or if you think of these just as little baseballs, little particles that behave like baseballs, it's completely bizarre that they would hit outside of the shadow region. How can an electron, which is going like this, somehow has to bend around this corner to hit over here, say, on the screen? Okay, so how is it possible for an electron to bend like that? Okay, so what, right away, we start to suspect that something might be wrong with classical mechanics. So classical particles, like baseballs, are described by F equals ma. Okay? The equation F equals ma applied to this situation would say that the particles just move on straight lines, and they will only hit somewhere in here. Okay? So the fact that in order to hit the screen over here, that involves some kind of bending of that path. Okay, and F equals ma can't account for that bending of the path. Okay, so we know already that this equation is in question. Our entire structure of classical mechanics is in question. This is the foundation of all of mechanics, all of Newtonian mechanics, and that's now suddenly in question, just from this very, very simple experiment. Okay, so we're going to talk a lot more about that as we go along here. Okay, so that's the single slit experiment. Okay. We'll talk about how we try to explain that later. Let's now move on to a second experiment. This is now put two slits. Okay, so if one slit gave you something interesting, let's try two slits. Okay, so double slit. Okay. Now we saw a little bit of weirdness starting to happen over here. When we add a second slit, something totally bizarre happens. Okay, something deeply strange begins to happen. Okay, so let's look at it. So here's our source of electrons, spinning on electrons, electron beam, with some momentum p. Okay, and we have our two slits. This. Okay, and I mean those a little bit too. Try to be neat and tidy, you know? Okay, so let me just sketch a little bit here and then I'll talk. Okay, and here's our screen here. All right. So we have now two slits, which we'll label number one and number two. Slit one, slit number two here. Okay, and let's suppose that we, instead of having both slits open, let's just go back to the single slit case. So we close this slit temporarily. Okay, so that means that there are no electrons getting through here. And we're back to the single slit case. Okay, so with the single slit case, sure, most electrons are just going to bounce off of this barrier, but some of them will pass through that slit and make it to this other side over here. And they're going to start hitting the screen over here. And there's going to be some pattern of hits on the screen here. Okay, and what we're going to imagine is that we've cranked down the momentum of the electrons quite low so that there's a significant amount of spreading of that pattern of hits. Okay, so if the momentum were really, really high, we would have them just hitting over here. We're going to crank that momentum so they hit actually quite broadly. Okay, so let's suppose that our pattern of hits, our probability curve, with just slit number one open, looks something like this. It's maximum over here, okay, but then it's but non-zero over a significantly wide range here. Okay, so this is, let's call this P1x. So this is the pattern of hits with just slit one open. Okay? Electron most likely to hit around here, but it also hits around here. Okay. And let's now reverse the situation. Let's open slit number two and close slit number one. Okay? Now we're going to get no electrons coming through this slit. All the electrons that get to the other side have come through slit number two. Okay, so now we're going to see a probability pattern which is maximum over here and then spreads to either side. Okay, so it's maximum here and it spreads to either side. Okay, so we'll call this guy p2 of x. That's the pattern of hits if only slit number 2 were open, according to our single slit results. Okay, so now what I want to consider is, let's look at a particular location on the screen. Okay, so dead center between the slits we'll call 0. Okay, remember this is x up here. So let's suppose that we go some distance out, some distance, say, d, along that screen, and we have a detector over here. Okay? Now, here's the thing. If only slit number 1 is open and slit number 2 is closed, then we get this pattern of hits over here, which means that, say, in a given amount of time, there's a chance, there's a certain probability of electrons hitting here. Over, say, 1 hour, on average, we might have, let's say, I don't know, say 10 hits in an hour. Okay, so we're talking with this slit open, the probability that electrons would hit here would be such that we would get maybe in an hour 10. 10 hits over here. Now suppose that we close this slit and open this one. Okay, so now the majority of electrons hit around here, but they can also hit as far away as here. Okay? Less of them though, because they've got to bend further, okay, to get there. So let's suppose that in an hour we would have, say, on average, I don't know, say less. This looks like, say, 3. Okay? So that's that. So what would you expect to happen if we open both slits? We have both slits open now, just to allow the electrons to go through either slit. In an hour, how many electrons would you expect to hit this detector here?
13.
Right? Okay, so what you would expect is you just add them up. Okay, so you just add these two probability curves, these two patterns. Let's add these two patterns up. So this plus this is, say, about here, this plus this here, and so on. So let's just add those two curves, just graphically here, and we get a curve which looks something like this. I'm trying to make it bolder. Okay, so this is expect. What we expect is just that the pattern of hits with both slits open is just the sum of the two, just add them up. Okay? So what we actually see is something totally different. Not just a little bit different, totally different. Qualitatively different. Okay, what we see is this. Okay, so actually, why don't I just draw that? Sorry, why don't I draw it over here? I'm drawing a separate picture. Getting rid of this. We expect the sum. What we actually see, and I'll just draw it by this line over here, so I don't totally mess things up. What we actually see is this sort of thing. So if this is our 0, and this is our, say, d over here, we'll see a pattern that maybe looks like this. So the actual pattern of hits is not what we expect. It's not simply P1 plus P2. Okay? This wiggly curve is totally different from this smooth curve like this, right? It's totally different. And in particular, I've chosen just a particular location on the screen here. It can turn out that with slit number 1 open, we get 10 hits here. With slit number 2 open by itself, we get 3. We would expect with both open, we get 13. There are locations on the screen where when you open both slits, instead of getting 10 plus 2 is 13, you get 0. Just 0. Okay? So no electrons hit here. Or here, or whatever. Okay? That is completely bizarre. Okay? There's, like, how is this possible? Okay? This is, if we're thinking of electrons, as simply ordinary particles like a baseball, except really, really small, there's no way that you could explain this. No way whatsoever. Okay? This pattern of hits happens even if we turn down the intensity of the electron being very, very low. Okay, if we turn the intensity down so that there's just one electron coming every 5 minutes, we'll see this. Bink, an electron leaves over here, you know, bink, hits the screen there. 5 minutes later, one, say, hits over there. Another 5 minutes later, one hits there, and so on. Okay, and we slowly build up a pattern of hits. And eventually, the pattern of hits that we see looks nothing like this, but looks like this. Okay, how is that possible? Okay, this is totally bizarre. That's the point. So what I want to show you is that this is, in fact, true. And there's a wonderful experiment here, which was done. Actually, only in 19... Stefan will know the year. It's 1997 or something like that. The company Hitachi actually conducted this experiment. So the experiment I've been talking about is actually technically very difficult to do. Okay, and technology was developed sufficiently only by 1997 or whatever to actually conduct this experiment. But physicists have known about experiments of this type for a long time. But this is an absolutely beautiful experiment. Let me show you this. So this is a real double slit experiment here. And right. These are the real results.
Here and there.
So
these individual electrons. Electrons are sent out only occasionally. Therefore, the chance of finding one electron in the microscope is very small. Okay. Not to mention the chance of finding two.
We're back here. Okay. Ready?
Since electrons are blocked. Now we are looking at the detector plane on the monitor. Bright spots appear here and there. These spots indicate individual electrons. Electrons are sent out only occasionally. Therefore, the chance of finding one electron in the microscope is very small. Not to mention the chance of finding two.
We got the two slits, and the electrons are coming out very, very slowly, like once every like 2 seconds or whatever, as you can see on the screen there. So there's only one electron at any time in the apparatus. Okay, so one electron is released, it hits the screen over there, then it hits over there, then it hits over there, and so you see these random points being generated on this two-dimensional screen. And so the main thing is, one, A, they occur randomly, at random locations, and B, we'll see the interference pattern emerge as time goes on here. So let's keep going.
Since electrons are detected one by one, we have to conclude that each electron must have passed through at random on either side of the bipolar, thus creating a uniform distribution without any interference when accumulated. Under such condition, do electrons form a uniform distribution? But look, we begin to see some fringes in the perpendicular direction that looks like interference fringes. Since this experiment lasted for more than 30 minutes, I have sped the movie up. Interference fringes are now clearly visible.
Okay, so these interference fringes, this interference pattern, where it's bright here, corresponds to a location that's high on this in this picture, and where it's dark is a location where it's highly unlikely that an electron hits, which is these types of locations over here. Okay? That's a real experiment showing you that this totally wacky result is in fact true. Okay? And it actually happens in the real world. Okay? Okay. So let's try to make some sense of this. So the way we're going to do this is we're going to compare. It turns out to be useful to compare these experiments, which are done with particles, to similar types of experiments done with waves. Okay? Comparison is particularly fruitful, and we will see this. So here we go. So let's start back with the single slit experiment. So we'll leave that up there. But we will talk about a similar single slit experiment, not done with particles, but done with waves. Okay, so here's what it looks like. And so we will title this thing diffraction. Okay, so instead of having a source of particles, electrons, we will have a source of waves here. Okay, so these waves are radiating outwards from this source point over here. As the wavelength, we will say the wavelength is lambda. If you put a lambda, typically used to indicate wavelength of waves. Okay, and we have a screen there with a single slit. Okay, and what we're going to, and then we have the screen here with detectors. Okay, first of all, when this wave hits this barrier here, the part of the wave that hits the barrier here is just going to be reflected off like this. The part of the wave that hits this barrier is going to be reflected off in this direction over here. Okay, but of course, some of the wave is going to pass through that slit. What's going to happen to that wave when it goes to the other side here?
Forms a new wave.
Okay, so does it form a new wave like this?
It's going to spread it around.
Okay, so it's going to spread. Can anyone explain why it's spreading?
Every point. You
got a hand up.
Every point is steep.
Every point is
steep.
Right. So that's Huygens' principle.
Yeah.
Okay, so the idea here is Huygens came up with this a long time ago, 5,000 years ago. Okay, so the idea is that in the slit here, every point in the slit acts as a single source of circular waves coming out. Okay, so this little guy produces a circular wave, this one a circular wave, and so on. And you add all those guys up, and you get a wavefront like that. Okay, and then these waves continue to spread like this. You add all those little circular waves up in your wavefront. But the point is, this guy in the corner here, for example, this guy is a source radiating circular waves. Those circular waves can go in all directions. So they can also go in that direction. So the wave that's coming in is just moving this way. It can even be just a plane wave coming in, moving this way. Okay, but then because these little circular waves radiate in all directions, that wave can effectively bend around the corner. Okay, so, and it depends, the amount of bending is called diffraction. The amount of diffraction, the spreading out of this, the angle of the spread, depends upon the wavelength in relation to the size of the slit. So for example, if sunshine streaming into a window leaves a bright spot on the floor with sharp edges. Okay, and so that corresponds to a case of very little spreading. Okay, so the sunlight comes in and it just basically goes straight through like that. Whereas, say the sound waves that I'm generating are passing through that little aperture over there, the door, the open door, and it's bending around. Okay? It's spreading out so that people in the hallway who are not in my direct line of sight can actually hear me yapping away. Okay, so that's bending around the corner. So waves have the ability to bend around corners, okay? Called diffraction. All right, so there we go. So we have this diffraction pattern like this, this spreading like this. And what we end up with is various patterns depending upon the wavelength. Okay, so where did I put my... There it is. My little pink chalk. Okay, so if the wavelength is very, very small, like sunlight passing through a window, then what we get is basically just a sharp pattern like this. That's a zero over there. So the pattern is sharp like this. And it drops off to zero. Okay, so this is the lit region, this is the shadow region. Okay, so this is for small wavelength. Okay, if we increase the wavelength, so that now, say for example, we're talking about sound waves. Sound wavelengths are maybe say this long compared to that door. Okay, so we need a longer wavelength, we get more diffraction, spreads wider, and the pattern looks like this. Okay, so this is large. That's large wavelength. Okay? So now we can compare with our single slit experiment, and we notice there's a marked similarity between those two types of curves. Okay, so one of them, this is what is this curve actually? What it is the intensity of the wave squared. So here's the wave, psi, we'll call it psi, Greek letter psi, indicating the amplitude of the wave. If we square that guy, so it's psi squared, that's called the intensity of the wave. So it looks as if the intensity of a wave, that pattern on the screen, is very similar to the probability of a particle hitting the screen. Intensity of wave is related to probability of particle. Okay, so that's the crucial point that we get from that. So it appears, so there's two things here, two key points. Okay, not only are they similar, they're actually exactly the same. Exactly. So it suggests very strongly that we identify, in other words, think of as the same, the square of the amplitude of the wave. The amplitude of the wave, like a water wave going up and down at a certain amplitude. We identify the square of the amplitude of the wave with the probability of a particle hitting at a certain location. So this is wave intensity. As particle probability. You notice that right away we're starting to identify a wave thing with a particle thing. Normally the two are totally distinct. Particles and waves are totally distinct. With this experiment, we're starting to see a connection between wave and particle properties of nature. Okay? So that's important. Second is there seems to be a relationship. In this case, we get very little, in the particle case, we get very little spreading when the momentum is large. Okay, so very little spreading when the momentum is large. In which case is there very little spreading here? Small lambda. Okay, when the momentum here is small, the electrons are going slow, we get large spreading. Okay, where do we get large spreading here? When the momentum when the wavelength is large. Right. Okay, so there seems to be an inverse relationship between momentum and wavelength. So here we're already starting to identify somehow, there's some relationship between waves and particles. Lambda is a wavelength is a property of a wave. Momentum is a property of a particle. So there seems to be already some kind of relationship between them. But it appears to be an inverse relationship. So we guess. Maybe there's a relationship of that type. Remember, science is not deductive. You can't deduce the laws of nature. You guess them. It's all about guessing, making good guesses, and then checking if those guesses are right by doing further experiments. Okay, so we're guessing that there's some kind of relationship between wavelength and momentum that looks like that—an inverse type relationship. Okay, right. So now let's look at this double slit experiment here. And we'll compare that double slit experiment with particles. With a similar double slit experiment involving waves. Okay, so first off, so, we're going to do a double slit experiment with waves. So what we have is a source of waves, like this, and it hits a screen with two slits in it, like that. And we will imagine that the wavelength is long enough so that there is a sufficient amount of spreading or diffraction through each of those slits individually. Okay, so as this wave, as this part of the wave hits this slit, there's a diffraction happening here that's appreciable. Okay, and similarly, when this part of the wave hits this open slit, there's an appreciable diffraction or spreading. Okay, such that we have these two diffraction patterns which overlap, producing what is called an interference pattern. Okay, so most of you know, how many know this stuff, interference, all that stuff? Okay, so when two crests together gives you a double crest, crest and a trough, they cancel, all that kind of stuff. Okay, so at the end of the day, we get a pattern, there's our zero, there's our x. We get a pattern of wave intensity, which looks something like this. And this is the wave amplitude squared. Okay? The waves can be positive or negative. We're squaring it so it's always positive. Okay? And that always positive quantity happens to match exactly with that probability curve. Okay? Exactly. Okay? But of course, this, the distance to the first minimum here, depends upon the wavelength. Okay? So that's crucial. So let me just comment on that a little bit more here. So, the detailed shape, the distance to the first minimum, depends on the wavelength. We can adjust it by adjusting the wavelength. Okay, so, here's my screen. Suppose I make lambda really small. So what I'm trying to do is, I'm trying to adjust the wavelength of the wave here. And that's going to change the shape of this curve. In fact, in particular, the distance to the first minimum. I want to adjust lambda so that this curve looks like exactly like that curve and has the minimum at the same location d. Okay, so if I make lambda too small, then what I will find is my pattern looks like this. It's too tight. Okay, so the distance to the first minimum here is too small. If I make lambda too large, as I increase the wavelength, what I'm going to do is I'm going to spread this guy out. The distance to the first minimum will get greater. Okay, and my interference pattern might look something like this. Okay, so the distance to the first minimum here is too large. But if I adjust lambda just right, then I can make that curve look exactly like that curve. Okay? And so, what we find is that the square of the wave amplitude, that pattern looks exactly like the probability pattern. They're exactly equal when there is a particular relationship between the wavelength and the momentum, when lambda is h divided by p. Okay, so back here, back somewhere there, we're guessing that there's some relationship between lambda and p, some proportionality. So we're saying that lambda, to say that lambda is proportional to 1 over p means that lambda is equal to some constant divided by p. And we can actually determine what that constant is by doing a double slit experiment and matching the wave amplitude squared with the probability. And so we can numerically determine this value of h. And you can actually numerically determine the value of h from the experiment I just showed you, that Hitachi experiment. Okay, so experimentally, all of you know the number. What's the number for h? What is h called? Planck's constant. What's the number?
6.636.
Excellent. Why can't I find the eraser?
There's two of them up above.
Two of them I got here. Okay. Okay. So then h is called Planck's constant. And it's 6.63. 10 to the minus 34 joule seconds. Okay, so it's just some number. It's a very important number, though. The numerical value is largely irrelevant, but the fact that it's non-zero is hugely relevant. Hugely relevant. Okay, so There we go. So now what we're going to do is this. Back here, what time are we about here? Oh, okay. So back here, we started to get some doubts about F equals ma. Okay? What is F equals ma? F equals ma underlies all of classical mechanics, underlies all of Newtonian mechanics. Okay, we're starting to have doubts about that. Okay? So and what we're going to do is it turns out that actually we need to replace F equals ma with a different with a different relationship. Okay? And that relationship we're going to guess is this guy over here. So what am I trying to say? So the idea is we can no longer use F equals ma to describe how electrons behave. We can use it to describe how baseballs behave, but not how electrons behave. So what we're going to try to do is use this, like we would use F equals ma. We'll treat this as a law of motion, so to speak, which will help us to understand how electrons behave. Okay? So that's the goal here. That's the game. And I think I was supposed to turn on this mic. I'm going to turn on this mic now. Oops. Sorry, Jacob.
Jacob is, we're going to video some of this stuff. Okay, so. Let's apply this, our new sort of equation for the dynamics of electrons. Let's, that is this lambda equals h over p. Let's apply that to a very, very simple situation and try to see what that relation, lambda equals h over p, tells us about the behavior or nature of particles, electrons or any kind of particle in general. And I should actually give this relation a name. This is called the de Broglie relation. Okay, so that was after the inventor of that relationship who first stated it. It looks like that should be pronounced de Broglie, but it's actually pronounced de Broglie, as far as I know. Okay, so particle in a box. So what we're going to imagine is, just like in this special relativity stuff, it's always simplest to deal in one spatial dimension. So we're going to imagine that we've got a particle inside a box. You can imagine it as a little bead on a wire, able to just slide back and forth in one dimension. Okay, except that it has a boundary at both ends, so it can only move between a certain range of x values. Okay, so that we'll call the particle in a box. Okay, so the particle can slide along this axis, but it has boundaries at these two points here. Okay, so we'll call those two points x equals 0 and x equals L, so the width of the box is L. And we're going to put a particle in this box, like a little bead on a wire. And that particle is going to do something. We don't know what it's doing. We'll see what it's doing is extremely odd. Okay, and so we'll just suppose we have some particle of mass m, and it's doing something in this box. Okay, and so don't really know. We'll just draw a little squiggly line there. The only thing that we're going to assume is that that this particle has a certain fixed amount of energy. So in other words, we've put some energy into that particle in the box. That particle is isolated from the environment. No energy in, no energy out. The energy inside remains the same. Okay, that energy has something to do with the motion of the particle. So we say, suppose we have a definite energy E. That's the only thing we're assuming. Okay? Now, given this situation, and using the de Broglie relation, lambda equals h over p, we're going to try to figure out what's going on with that electron. What can be said about that electron or that particle's behavior? Okay, so, well, let's see. First of all, we've got a relationship, lambda equals h over p. All we know is the energy E. Is there something we can we determine lambda or P using E? What does the energy of the particle tell us? Does it tell us anything about the momentum? What is the relationship between energy and momentum? What is it? Yeah. Okay, so the energy classically, the energy, when I say classically, I mean non-quantum mechanically, just ordinary physics. Okay, so energy E is 1/2 mv squared, because the energy of the particle is just only kinetic energy. It just has energy of motion. There's no potential energy here. So the energy is just purely kinetic, 1/2 mv squared. And if we use that momentum is mass times velocity, then this is the same thing as p squared divided by 2m. Okay? And especially in quantum mechanics, momentum is much more relevant and important than velocity. We never deal with velocities. We always deal with momentum. Okay, so I have that the energy is p squared over 2m. What does that tell me that p is? What is p? Square root of 2m. 2me. Is that it? Is that all?
Yes, positive and negative. That's extremely important here. Okay, that's one general lesson about physics is whenever you have some mathematical description of a system, when you find solutions, always find the most general solution. Always find all possible solutions and investigate the nature of every single possible solution. It has always turned out in physics that all of the solutions turn out to be relevant in one way or another. Okay, and being careful about finding all the solutions, for example, has resulted in the discovery of antimatter. Okay, so it's exactly the same, in fact, it's the same kind of plus minus sign, which is whatever. Okay, so momentum is then plus or minus that. Okay, so what does a positive momentum mean? Forward motion, so moving to the right. The negative means moving to the left. Okay, so the plus minus means that the particle has, it's got some energy, so it can be moving to the, but it can be moving to the right or the left with the momentum plus or minus that square root. Okay, and knowing now the momentum, we plug that into this relationship, lambda equals h over p. P in that relationship is just the magnitude, the absolute value. The negative wavelength doesn't make any sense. Okay, so what we just mean is the magnitude. So the wavelength is h divided by root 2me. Okay? So let's look at these two cases, p equals plus and p equals minus. So if p is plus square root of 2me, what have we got? Well, what we have is somehow a particle moving to the right, which must somehow be associated with a wave moving to the right, because de Broglie tells us that associated with p is some kind of a wavelength. There must be some kind of a wave involved. So what we imagine is a wave moving to the right, like this. Okay, but if we have a wave moving to the right, okay, that's fine, except we've got a barrier here. Okay, the right x equals l there. Okay, when that wave hits the barrier, what's going to happen? It's going to reflect, and it's going to reverse. Okay, so we have this wave coming in, this wave traveling to the right, it reflects off the boundary, and now we have a wave traveling to the right plus a wave traveling to the left. Okay, so we have a wave moving to the right and a wave moving to the left. So this is right and left. Okay, that's very important. We're going to talk a lot about that. So there's necessarily a reflected wave. If p is equal to minus square root of 2mv, we're talking about a particle moving to the left, but somehow associated with a particle, momentum p, is some kind of a wave. So we have a wave that starts out moving to the left, like this. Okay, but there's a barrier at x equals 0. Okay, when it hits that barrier, it's going to reflect. And we're going to end up not only with a left-moving wave, but in addition, a right-moving wave. There are both waves present at the same time. So the lesson here is that this relationship, this de Broglie relation, lambda equals h over p, basically forces us into the idea that there are two waves present. Okay, there must be two waves present. If the particle is bound to bound in some kind of a box and is somehow associated with a wave, then that wave is going to reflect off and produce a reflected wave. And if we start on the right moving, we must also have a left. If we start on the left moving, we must also have a right. So it must be true that both waves are present. Okay, so that's important. So we're forced into having both waves present. Now I want to show you a really nice applet here. Has just died. Hello. Wake up. Is power not on? That's really unfortunate. I'm very sad. This was such a cool outlet.
Oh. Something
there behind you. Oh, gotcha now. I know what's happening. Okay, I'm an idiot.
It's actually a little bit crazy. Is it really cool?
Oh, there we go. Excellent. Gotcha. No, we don't want to change that. Okay, go back to that. Okay, here we go. So what this is going to show is exactly this situation. We're going to have a traveling wave that we assume is initially traveling to the right. It's going to hit a barrier. It's going to reflect and produce also, in addition, a wave traveling to the left. Both right and left are present at the same time, and they will produce what? They will add to produce what? A standing wave, a single wave called a standing wave. Okay, so how many of you have actually studied standing waves? Okay, here we go. Lots of you. So here it is. So here's the single wave traveling to the right. Okay, so this is imagine that the particle has momentum plus in the plus direction. Okay, it is associated with a wave moving to the right. Okay. So now as this wave moves to the right, eventually it's going to hit this barrier and reflect. So I just want to emphasize here that particle moving to the right and wave moving to the right. Okay. Now it reflects here from the barrier, and you see that the blue wave is now the reflected wave. Okay? There's still, because the particle is associated with a wave, that's actually an infinitely long wave train. Okay? So we still have the original right moving wave, but now in addition we have the left moving blue wave that is present. Okay, so as soon as we introduce the idea of waves now, with a barrier, so a bound wave, we have both right and left moving. And you'll notice that when they add up, you get what is called a standing wave. That's this guy in black. Okay, so the red is the right moving traveling wave, the blue is the left moving traveling wave, and the black is the standing wave. And one thing you'll notice about the standing wave, it's called a standing wave because it isn't moving. Okay, so you'll notice that there are places labeled N here, which are called nodes. At these points over here, the black wave, there's no wave motion whatsoever, nothing's waving. Okay, whereas at the antinode labeled A, the wave motion is maximum. It comes down here, and then it goes all the way back up here. Okay, so the standing, so that's a standing wave, if you haven't seen that before. Okay, so the point is when you add two traveling waves, you get a standing wave. And right. Okay. Okay, so what? So what about all? Well, so we add this wave moving to the right, which we'll call psi right. Together with this wave moving to the left, called psi left, and inside that box, what we get is this standing wave.
Okay, and this standing wave is such that what's happening is these are nodes. They don't move. And it looks kind of like this. When this guy's going down, this one's going up. So it's doing this sort of thing. Okay? And the key point here is if the particle is bound, then there are only certain allowed wavelengths. Okay? So essentially what we're saying is in order to have this particle bound properly, we have to put the boundary of the box on one of these nodes. So the left boundary, for example, might occur over here, okay, in which case there's no wave over here. And the right boundary we could put over here, okay, in which case there's no wave over here. Okay, if we started a wave oscillating like this inside inside a box like this, it would just continue to oscillate forever. Okay, so this is like the various modes on a guitar string. Okay, so you probably all know about this. I could have, say, this mode over here, the fundamental, then the first harmonic, the second harmonic, and so on and so forth. The point is that the boundary of the box must be at the nodes, okay, because there can't be any wave motion at the boundary. Okay, so basically, the situation must be thought of as two traveling waves. Okay, so that's, the first thing to say. Okay, and those traveling waves are associated with the two possible momenta, p equals plus or minus square root of 2me. Okay, so there are two traveling waves present, and they are self-reinforcing upon multiple reflections. Okay, so this standing wave, which exists inside this box, is really two traveling waves going back and forth. And they're reflecting and always self-reinforcing each other and keeping each other alive. Okay, so it requires, but this picture requires the superposition or happening simultaneously two classically mutually exclusive alternatives. Okay, so what do I mean? Well, one alternative is, classically, you would think of the particle inside the box as moving either to the right or to the left. Okay, so let me actually state this really explicitly, because this is the central problem here, the central mystery of quantum mechanics. Okay, so classically, we have this kind of situation. We have a particle moving to the right or a particle moving to the left. Okay, so at any instant of time, the particle, say, is over here, it could be moving to the right or the left. Okay, quantum mechanically, or in the real world, in this microscopic world, this microscopic real world, what we are saying is the fact that we have a standing wave like this means that a standing wave is composed of two traveling waves, one moving to the right and one moving to the left. They are both present at the same time. Okay? So in quantum mechanics, if a particle is in any way associated with a wave, it must be true that what's happening somehow, in some totally inexplicable way, it must be true that the particle is in some kind of a weird, non-classical state in which it is simultaneously moving to the right and the left at the same time. Okay, so instead of, in the classical world, we would expect traveling to the right or the left, in the quantum world, we are seeing a superposition of those two possibilities. Okay, the particle is traveling to the right and the left simultaneously. How is that possible? Like, how does that make any sense? This is the fundamental mystery of quantum mechanics. Okay? So there is no ordinary notion of particle motion inside that box. You cannot think of that particle as somehow bouncing around. It's doing something that's completely inexplicable, that cannot be described at all, or cannot be understood at all based upon our day-to-day experience with baseballs. What's happening inside that box is a fundamental mystery. Okay? It's fundamentally different from what's happening in the big everyday world. Okay, so small is different. There is something truly different about how things behave in the atomic and subatomic world. It is truly new. This relationship, lambda equals h over p, is something fundamentally new, adds something fundamentally new to our understanding of nature. Okay. So, where are we at here, time-wise? Okay. So, let me just say a couple of words here. First of all, allowed standing waves. Well, let's actually use the word orbital. We're going to use that later. You may have heard of orbitals in connection with what? Atoms, right? The quantum nature of atoms. The word orbitals is the same, is applied with the same meaning over here. So the idea is just this. I'll just go through this very quickly here. So here we have a particle in a box between 0 and L. And one possible standing wave, the simplest standing wave, the lowest frequency standing wave, is this one. Okay, so it's fixed at both ends here, and it's just vibrating back and forth like this, up and down. Okay, so we'll call this wave sine 0. Okay, this standing wave sine 0. What is the wavelength here in relation to the length?
2L.
Because if I were to continue this sine wave like this, the full wavelength would be 2L. Right? So lambda is equal to 2L, and knowing that, so this is a wave, but to get the corresponding particle probability, we square that wave. If I square this wave, I'll get a curve which looks like this. Okay? So we square that. Remember, we square the wave intensity here, the wave amplitude to get the wave intensity, and we identify that with particle probability. So what that's saying is, if the particle is in this state, this quantum state of this weird kind of moving to the left and the right at the same time, if we measure the position of the particle, we will find, most likely we will find it to be in, say, this region. Most often we'll find it to be around the middle, because that's where the probability pattern is high. It's very unlikely that we will find it near the edges of the box. That's what that curve means. Okay, what is the energy? The energy associated with the particle in this weird quantum state of moving right and left simultaneously, and that is this lowest state here. But what is the energy? The energy is just kinetic energy, p half mv squared, or p squared over 2m. What is p? P equals h over lambda, de Broglie. So it's h, so p squared will be h squared over lambda squared. Okay, so using, so this is a classical statement, energy is p squared over 2m. We use this new insight into the nature of nature, and we replace p with h over lambda, and it says that the energy is h squared over 2m lambda squared. What is the wavelength? 2L. Let's plug it in here. So that's h squared over 4 times 2 is 8ml squared. So what that's saying is this first standing wave over here, if a particle is in this state, it has this kind of, this is called a wave function. If it's in this state of motion here, this weird quantum state of motion, its energy is Planck's constant, that number that we can determine from an Attachi experiment or whatever, divided by L squared, and there's the mass in there. Okay? So the energy just depends upon basically the size of the box, the L there. Okay, now let's consider the second one, the second possible standing wave. The second possible standing wave is this guy over here. This one has two nodes, one at either end. This one has three nodes, one at either end and one in the middle. Okay, what is the wavelength here? Okay. Now, this is the wave itself, the wave amplitude. To get the probability, I square that. Okay, so the probability of finding the particle at any given location, I square this. If I square a positive, I get a positive. So zero there, there, and there. Zero there, there, and there. I square this part of the curve, and I'll get a curve that looks like that. I square this, it's negative. I square it, it becomes positive again. Probabilities, remember, this is a wave amplitude if we positive or negative.
it's actually oscillating back and forth like this. This is a probability. It has to only be positive. You can only have positive probabilities. So that's why we square. Or that's consistent with the idea that we're squaring. So the probability of finding, if the particle is in this weird quantum state, then the probability of finding the particle at any given location, if I look in the box, it's likely that I'll find it somewhere in this region over here, or in this region over here. But it's unlikely I'll find it near here, the center, or near the two sides. That's what that curve means. What is the energy in this case? The energy in the state that we're calling number one here is, same idea, p squared over 2m is equal to h squared over 2m lambda squared. And plugging in lambda is equal to L there, we get h squared over 2ml squared. Okay? The point is that this is 4 times E0. Let's make a note of this. The energy is 4 times as high going to the next state. So to summarize all of this, we have the following picture. We've discovered the following. This is remarkable. Just using that experimental result, lambda equals h over p, using lambda equals h over p, like we would use f equals ma to try to learn something about the nature of the behavior of the electron, we've discovered that the particle in a box here, if we plot its energy, the allowed values of energy. So these are the allowed standing waves here. Corresponding to those allowed standing waves, we have these allowed energies. Okay, so the lowest energy here is down. This is zero energy here. This is the energy we call E0. The energy E1 is 4 times as large. So 1, 2, 3, 4. This is E1. The energy E2 for the next standing wave turns out to be 9 times. E3. And so on. So what we notice is, so E3 is 9 E0. I'm sorry, E2. Okay, so what we notice is that the energy is quantized. Okay, this is where the word quantum comes from. So the energy cannot just be any energy, it has certain discrete values. So let me just summarize this as follows. So any bound particle as soon as we put a particle in a box, okay, that corresponds to a bound wave because p equals h over lambda, or lambda equals h over p. Okay, there's some wave associated with it. So any bound particle means a bound wave. As soon as we have a bound wave, that means that it's going to hit a boundary and reflect. And not only is there a right-moving wave, now there's also a left-moving wave. And so there's going to be standing waves. Okay, and for those traveling waves bouncing back and forth to reinforce with each other constructively to maintain their existence, it means that there can only be certain allowed wavelengths. Okay, certain allowed wavelengths means certain allowed momenta and so on. So bound wave, first of all, means discrete harmonics. Okay, so only certain allowed standing waves or discrete orbitals. Okay. So let me put it this way, actually. Bound wave, so discrete wavelengths, which means discrete momenta. Because lambda is h over p, or p is h over lambda, which tells you quantized energy or discrete energy. Quantized energy. So what I'm trying to say here is that the real, the really bizarre thing about quantum mechanics is not so much that energy is quantized. At the heart of this quantized energy is the fact that particles are associated with waves. And bound particles means bound waves means standing waves.
Okay. The second point to make here, just to finish off here, is that the lowest energy that's allowed is not zero. The lowest energy that's allowed is bigger than zero. And this is called zero point energy. Okay, and this is extremely important. This, the fact that the lowest energy, we'll talk much more about this, but the fact that the lowest energy is not zero is the reason why this table exists, for example. Is the reason, so the fact is, and I'll emphasize this a lot more as we go along, the fact is that an atom cannot exist in Newton's universe. In a universe that, as Newton had envisioned, and Maxwell and these guys, atoms cannot exist. Okay? So this table can't exist. I can't exist. You can't exist. Stars can't exist. Nothing can exist. Okay? In order for atoms to exist, the reason why they were able to exist is intimately connected with the fact that that energy is not zero. Okay? And so we're going to talk a lot about that. That's the central, that's one of the central reasons why quantum mechanics is important. Okay? And that's it. So let me just give you, we have some quantum assignments here. So quantum exercises. So we'll give you these quantum exercises. Is that right? Do we have copies of them?
Yeah, we do have copies, but then...
you want to hand them out this afternoon?
Yeah, we might.
We're going to hand them out this afternoon. You know why? Because you guys started working on them right away. Bad.
Yeah, like you guys never start working on the exercises when you're supposed to be eating. We want you guys to eat.
Yeah, you guys go and eat now. So go to the bistro. Get